I feel like I'm at the very bottom of the mountain. There's so much more that I want to do. There's so much more that I want to accomplish. I feel like I'm just starting. I'd be lying to you if I didn't doubt myself, if I didn't question myself. There's been a lot of roadblocks. And there I am, like an idiot, wearing my snazzy suit. And he tells me we can't use you because Dana White put a kibosh on this. I've had this moment many times throughout my life. Like, how did I end up here? Like, I remember sitting on the set of SportsCenter and being like, Jewish kid from Montreal, you don't end up here. If it ended today, I'd be incredibly disappointed. I won't stray away from what got me here, but maybe there's a world where one day, better if it's just the Ariel Helwani show.
You said that having kids not only changed your life, but saved your life.
If I didn't have kids, I would be in my home or apartment just obsessing over work. I got hit up by Logan Paul to be on his podcast, Impulsive, which is a pretty big podcast. Two of my kids had soccer games, so I had to turn it down. That took precedent.
When were you happiest in your career?
Oh, yes. It is a good question. Would you believe me if I said...
So whenever someone comes to me, they want podcast advice. Hey, Troy, I'm starting a podcast. What would you recommend I do? I give them the same blanket advice. Less is more. Be consistent. 45 to 55 minutes. Respect your listeners' time. You, however, have built a career on the exact same format that you've been doing the last 10 years. 3 to 5 hours nonstop live on YouTube, then turned into a podcast. It still works for you. Dare I say, your shows are performing better than they ever have. And it is the exact opposite of what I would advise anyone in their right mind to do. Why does this strategy still work for you?
And yes, we've actually butted heads
a little bit,
quite a bit over this, this theory of yours, which is why I called you TST, aka Tight Ship Troy, because before I got to ESPN, no one ever spoke to me about any of this. The first time, so I'm working at AOL in 2009. They have a studio. What was it like? It was downtown. It was near Union Square in New York City, and they have like a whole big office. And in the office, there's a small studio with just like, you know, a little board here and a couple of microphones. And I see a camera in the corner of the room. It looks like a security cam. And I was a huge, you know, sports talk radio fan. I was a huge Howard Stern fan. I still am. And I've always wanted to do the radio show slash TV show, which is now very common. Someone, you know, wearing headphones, microphone, speaking, having guests. But at the time, maybe a little less common on the internet. And so I asked the people at AOL, can I do this? And they said, yeah, sure. You could do it for 15 minutes. Let's do it a 15-minute show. And even then, I was like, yo, like my intro is 15 minutes long. I don't believe in that. And by the way, I grew up listening to Howard Stern. Howard Stern was 4 hours a day. I didn't understand why anyone would say 15-hour, like this is silly. If it's good, it's good. And especially on the internet, when you can, you know, take little bites out of the apple throughout the day or throughout the week. And so we settled on an hour, hence the name the MMA Hour, which started in June of 2009. And slowly but surely that went to 90 minutes, and then it went to 2 hours, and it went to 2.5, and 3 hours, and 4, and 5, and blah, blah. And no one ever stopped me. No one ever stopped me until I got to ESPN. And, you know, it was good and bad because ESPN really cared. They looked at the numbers. They looked at the data. They were all about the data. And I remember 3 weeks into the job, I was asked to come to a meeting, and there was all kinds of sheets and data and saying people drop off here and there. And like, to me, I didn't care about that stuff. If the content is good, if the interviews are good, if the flow is good, if the energy is good, who cares? Because sometimes the best stuff happens in the fourth hour as opposed to the first hour. And I just feel like it's the internet. The beauty of the internet is you're not fitting things into schedules and into slots, right? You can just do whatever you want for as long as you want. And there are some people who still to this day, you know, who's the most famous podcaster, maybe Joe Rogan, his show is 3-4 hours with just one guest, you know, as opposed to multiple like I like to do. And so we used to go back and forth on this, and then we settled on, you can't go past 3 hours. First it was 3.5, then it was 3. And then it was the podcast, you can't go past an hour and this and that. And it would just drive me nuts. It would drive me nuts because in my opinion, if it's good, it's good. Coincidentally, 2 weeks before the pandemic, I was brought into another meeting. This is now February of 2020. One. And I was told it's not going past 2 hours now. And I was distraught. I was depressed. I remember. How can I do 2 hours? This is impossible. I'd almost rather not do the show if I'm confined to 2 hours. That never happened. Pandemic hits. My show with DC starts. And even there, it was like, it only has to be an hour. I'm like, there's nothing going on in the world. Let us go for 8 hours. Who cares? Never understood it. And this is perhaps why when I came back, I'm doing 3-4 hours on Monday, and then another 3-4 hours, and then the Ringer show, which is an hour and a half, 2 hours, and this, that, and the other, and there's no restrictions. And so ultimately, to answer your question in a roundabout way, I just feel like if it's good, it's good. And the people will watch it. And if they don't like it, they'll turn it off. Who cares? It doesn't matter. If it's crap, then they'll tell you. But they've yet, like, I don't ever hear from fans, your stuff is too long. Maybe they say, oh, I didn't get to it. But they never say, like, I want less. If anything, they want more. So, you know, it's even like those walk-in talks I used to do back in the day. Those were 1 hour unedited walking with Eddie Alvarez around Philadelphia or walking with Connor, like one straight hour of talking unedited. I've never edited any of the interviews. There's a reason why I always want my shows to be live or as live as can be. The show that I do with you and Chuck and Pizzi is like the first time I ever really did anything taped. And it wasn't supposed to be like that, as you know. It was supposed to be live. It was supposed to emanate first on Spotify Live and then go on podcast. Things changed, and so be it. But I like it live. I like it fresh. I like it as long and uncut as can be. And I just want to be as transparent as possible. So I don't know. Maybe it works because I care, because I have passion, because the content is good, because the guests are good. I don't really know. The people are the better ones to answer that. But I've never, ever, ever subscribed to the less is more. And I honestly don't care about the data. I don't care about drop off, listener rate. It's all bullshit to me. Just put out the good work. And if it's quality stuff, people will come.
One of the biggest problems that I face as someone who puts stuff out, whether that's writing, podcasts, I'm sure a lot of other people feel this way, is kind of balancing what am I interested in? What do I want to say versus, well, what does my audience want to read and hear? How much do you, like when you're figuring out who to have on, what questions to ask, how much do you balance kind of what you just want to put out versus what you know your audience wants, even though you might not want what your audience wants?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when I first started, I was steadfast in this belief that I'm the MMA guy. And I need to really stick to that, to the point where I remember talking to one other media guy who I remember was tweeting a lot about the Packers. And I'm like, hey, man, people don't follow you about the Packers. You need to stick to MMA. That's what I do. I only tweet about MMA. 1% is about other things, if that. And now, as you can probably see, a lot has changed. And that's partially because we evolve as people. And interests evolve, and you just want to keep things fresh. I mean, there's no rules. I was just applying this rule to my, you know, to myself. You know, no one told me to do this. And that's partially due to how I viewed myself. In the beginning, I had one singular goal. I wanted to be the best MMA journalist, host, reporter, whatever you want to call me, in the world. And I'm not saying that I am that guy. It's up to other people to decide that. But obviously, I've been in the game for a long time, and you do a lot of shows, and you interview a lot of people, and you win those awards, and it's all very nice. And then I have other goals, and I have other aspirations. I've never once considered not being the MMA guy, but I also want to be the other guy too. I want to be the combat sports guy. I want to be the general interview guy. I want to be the, you know, if you go down the list of sport, the boxing guy, the sports, the NBA guy, the basketball guy, the soccer guy, the darts guy, whatever. You know what I mean? I just want to be someone who is entertaining and someone who is an escape for people. And so, yes, I do think it's important that when people tune into your show, and let's say it's called the MMA Hour, you do kind of stick to that. Obviously, even with that, I'm evolving, and it's you know, part of the reason why I would eventually, it's not really breaking news because I've hinted at this, want to change the name. Because like you look at someone like Pat McAfee, right? When I think of Pat McAfee, I think of football. And Pat McAfee is the gold standard, and he's doing incredibly well. And I'm honored to know him, and it's just inspiring what he's built for himself. You think of Pat McAfee, you think of football. That's kind of like his house, his anchor. But when there's big news in basketball, he's talking to a basketball guy. When there's big news in football, like college, he's talking about that as well as the NFL. He's talking about baseball. He's talking randomly about hockey. He talks fighting sometimes, right? He has MMA guys on. He has Dana White on. And so maybe there's a world where one day, you know, MMA is my anchor. It's my house. But then there's the other things, right? And I don't have to listen anymore to like, why do you have Canelo Alvarez on? It's called the MMA Hour. Why do you have Eddie Hearn on? It's called the MMA Hour. Why do you have Cody Rhodes on? It's called the MMA Hour. Well, maybe it's better if it's just the Ariel Helwani show. And I do also, and so I won't stray away from what got me here, but I also don't want it to just be the Ariel Helwani show in that I will only talk about, let's say, the Knicks. Because then it's like really just catering to what I like. You know, I'm not listening to a Boston Celtics podcast, but if the Celtics are in the news, you got to talk about the Celtics. It can't just be like, all right, I'm going to talk MMA fighters that I like, boxers that I like, pro wrestling, Knicks, Bills, Nottingham Forest, and darts. Like no one has those same interests, right? It doesn't exist. It would be very selfish to do that and kind of stupid as well, because I wouldn't have a large following. It would be just catered to an audience of one. So yeah, my line of thinking has evolved. My stance on this has evolved, where it was just MMA, MMA, MMA. And I think that's fine, but I also think it's important to not just program for yourself, because that would be, you know, very narrow-minded.
What do you find most fulfilling about what you do?
Oh, the interviews, 1,000%. Like there's no greater high than the whole process. Booking the guests, getting the guest on, like seeing them on the screen. Oh, because booking the guests is stressful as hell. And I've booked every single guest on my show since 2009. And it's an insane thing. And it's the process that I hate the most of my weekly life. But I don't know. I only trust myself to do it for whatever reason. So that process is stressful. You get to that part, you get the guest, you get the okay. it's a hit. It's like a dopamine hit. And like, you're like, it's a true high that I get off of it. But then let's say I book someone on a Wednesday for a Monday show or a Thursday for a Monday show or Saturday. Then I'm anxious about said guest canceling, not showing up between the time I book them to the time they show up on the screen. And then Sunday night, let's say it's a Monday show, Sunday night, I'm checking my phone. I'm terrified to look at my phone Monday morning. I've had a couple of times where you look at the phone and like, hey, sorry, I can't make it today. Oh, what a feeling. It's part of the reason why I used to announce the guests on Sunday and now I do it on Monday morning, just because I don't want to announce someone and then they bail. And then they show up and that's a huge high. And then you get the interview, and especially when it's a big one, when it's exclusive and like you feel like everyone's watching, it's a Nate Diaz interview or Francis Ngannou interview or a Conor McGregor interview. And then you just kind of go home and you're just floating. And I just love, I love the process of once you're talking to the person, asking questions, digging, zigging when they're trying to zag. You know, it's sometimes like a fight, like they're trying to evade your questions and not really answer things, and you kind of have to hit them with a jab, but not in a bad way. But you know, like there's like a game, there's a dance going on, and I love that. And I love the arc of the interview. I love the beginning, the middle, the end. How are you going to start it? How are you going to crescendo? How are you going to end the interview? If I can interview people for the rest of my days, every single day, I prefer that much more than being a pundit. And really, like the personality, Helwani, whatever it is, that only started at ESPN. When I got to ESPN, the only thing they wanted me to do was the show with Chael. And even Chael had a hard time coming to terms with this because Chael knew me as the interview guy. And what they wanted was me and Chael debating. They wanted Skip and Stephen A. And I'd never really been that guy. And credit to them, they would always tell me like, no, more, more, more. Like, we want more of you. We don't care about the breaking news. We don't even care about the interviews. We want more of you. Felt great. It really built my confidence up. To where now, like back in the day, MMA Hour, you know, now I'll go like an hour and a half on the show without a single guest. Back in the day, I wouldn't go 10 minutes. That would give me great anxiety. Like what? I'm just going to speak. And now it obviously helps that I have great co-pilots now, right? Massive, changed everything. Obviously, New York Rick has been there for a very long time since 2012, but getting Connor Burks as well and Mysterious Frank, like now I just feel like I could do a 4-hour. I mean, we just did on Wednesday, of this past week, we just did a 3.5 to 4 hour show with not a single guest. And there was not one part of, I mean, actually it's my favorite show of the year because I don't have to book a single guest. It's everyone else's least favorite show of the year because there's so many elements that go into it. But for me, I just showed up like, this is great. I love this. So anyway, all to say, even though I hate the booking part, just because it's a grind and I hate asking people for favors, there's no greater satisfaction that I get than interviewing someone, it being a good conversation, and then just kind of floating in the air afterwards.
Your childhood dream was that you wanted to be the Howard Cosell of MMA. For those of you who don't know, Howard Cosell, famous, ultra-respected broadcaster. Did you ever doubt that that would happen?
Well, I would go a step further. And by the way, shout out to the great Howard Cosell. There he is. Looks at me every single day. Wow. I mean, is that not something?
I didn't know that
signed.
Existed.
Did you know I had
what
this?
What does it say?
It says Howard Cosell.
Okay. This is I didn't know if it had a note to it.
Howard Cosell. No, actually, a fan named Anthony gave me this as a gift. Howard Cosell is no longer alive. And so it's pretty incredible that I get to look at this every day. It's kind of an inspirational thing. In any event, I don't want it to fall. I'm just going to put it here so it doesn't fall. The childhood dream wasn't necessarily be the Howard Cosell of MMA. It was just to be a great sports broadcaster. And then when I got to Syracuse University in 2001 and I realized, oh, wow, for the first time in my life, there's actually people around me that all have the same dream as me. There's thousands of kids here at Syracuse who all want to be the exact same thing that I want to be, the next Bob Costas or Marv Albert, whatever. That's when I told my parents, you know, I don't like to be, you know, the same. I remember where I was sitting when I said this to them. I don't want to be like everyone else. I want to be different. And there's this thing that I love called mixed martial arts. And there's this organization called the UFC and no one's covering it. And maybe I could be the guy, maybe I could be the Howard Cosell of this sport. And so that's when it really started, which now is, you know, we're approaching 23 years since that conversation, which blows my mind. So, you know, I was in 2001, I was 19 and still very much in my infancy. And, you know, obviously the journey has taken me in different places, right? Like, you know, I do a show at Syracuse for 3 years. I graduate. I'm actually in production. I work in TV production for 3.5 years. I'm not really thinking about being on air anymore, but this idea keeps coming up and the passion is there. And that's when I really go all in 2007. I start my own website, jerrypark.com. I do the interviews with the fighters. I give myself 6 months to get noticed. And then, you know, the whole thing kind of starts from there, but I'd be lying to you if I didn't doubt myself, if I didn't question myself. And of course, as people know, there's been a lot of roadblocks. I've had to eat a lot of shit sandwiches along the way, as I like to say. And so, yes, there have been times where I've obviously been down, questioned, and I sit here today on this, you know, this Friday in January, hopefully I'm not dating us here, where, like, if you think I feel like I made it or I've reached the mountain, I feel like I'm at the very bottom of the mountain. There's so much more that I want to do. There's so much more that I want to accomplish. I feel like I'm just starting. And if it ended today, I'd be grateful. I'd be thankful. I'd be appreciative. I'd be really disappointed. I'd be incredibly disappointed. I feel like I hope and pray to have another 30, 40 years. And I want to do a lot more. And I feel like I'm just getting started as far as those other dreams are concerned. So yeah, to answer your question, of course I've had moments where I've doubted, questioned, but I don't feel like I'm the Howard Cosell of MMA. I don't feel like I'm 1/10 as talented as or successful, accomplished as Howard Cosell or any of the great broadcasters that I looked up to. So it's hard for me to answer that because I don't think I did it yet. It's been great, it's been fun, it's been exciting, it's been exhilarating. I'd say the best thing that I've been able to develop is when I've questioned myself. When I've doubted myself, I don't stay too low for too long. You know, I don't sit there and say, woe is me. Let me lick my wounds. Let me feel sorry for myself. All that stuff. I say, nah, I'm gonna prove you wrong. And maybe the greatest example of that, sorry for going long here, but maybe the greatest example of that is when I was hired to do the Showtime World Tour, McGregor Mayweather thingy, whatever you want to call it. It was like LA, Toronto, Brooklyn, 3 straight days. And I was going to be a part of the Showtime team, which was huge for me because I never worked for Showtime. And this was like Mayweather McGregor was the fight of the century. It was such a big deal. It was MMA and boxing coming together. It was gigantic. And there I am in LA, take the red eye after doing my show. I was in Vegas on a Saturday night. I flew home on a Sunday, did my show on a Monday in New York, and then left from the studio back to the airport to go to LA and get to my hotel at like 2 a.m., wake up to a text message from Steven Espinoza who says, can we meet at the hotel before the first leg of this world tour? And I'm like, this ain't good. And there I am, like an idiot, wearing my snazzy suit. And he tells me we can't use you because, you know, Dana White put a kibosh on this. And I started crying. And this is 2017. I'm 35. And I'm crying in front of him. And I could have like ran back to the hotel room. I could have felt sorry for myself. I said, fuck that. I'm going to cover this fight better than anyone on the planet. I'm going to cover this fight better than any outlet on the planet. And I feel like I did that. I got exclusive interviews multiple times with Conor. I got exclusive interviews multiple times with Floyd. I was at his freaking strip club 3 days before the event, waiting there for 6 hours. I had an in-studio guest every single week leading up to that fight, covered it from all angles. We did live shows from Radio Row over there better than anyone. We had Isaiah Thomas break news about Kyrie Irving on my show that made it to PTI. It was ridiculous. So I could have felt sorry. I could have felt down. But every time these things seem to happen, I say, F that, I'm going to level up.
What more do you want to do?
Oh my God. That's going to be like a 3-hour answer. There's so much more that I want to do. I want, this is the dream. Again, the dream was Howard Cosell of MMA. I'm not the Howard Cosell of MMA. I don't think anyone could ever
You're
be
better.
The Howard. No, I don't think so. He is unbelievable.
This is the cost of this is both the blessing and the curse for great people like yourself. You never realize just how good you are and how far you've come along. So you have to have other people tell you. There is not a single other person in sports broadcasting who can do what you do. There might be better interviewers. Like you might say Bob Kost is a better interviewer than me, a handful of other people. Yes. But not a single one of them can interview people for 4 hours straight, have good conversations while also simultaneously worrying about, is the next person going to show up? Is everything going on all right in the back room? I just got this message about like this person's running now 10 minutes late. Now I have to think about extending this conversation. Like you are juggling so many different things. No one else in the world can do what you do.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Howard Cosell was on Monday Night Football. He was on Monday Night Baseball, which was a thing back in the day on ABC. I ain't on those platforms. So I know things have evolved over time and maybe the platforms are different, but like, I'm not calling the Super Bowl. I'm not. So there's a lot of other things. And I don't even really necessarily dream of that. But there's things that I want to do and accomplish. And there's people that I want to talk to. One big thing for me is, God willing, going to happen this summer. I'm getting to cover the Olympics for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, our version, for those that may not know, of the BBC. They are the public broadcaster in Canada, the home of the Olympics for as long as I can remember, as prestigious as it can be. Here in America, the home of the Olympics is NBC. In Canada, it's CBC. I'm Canadian. This is like the greatest honor. And what's crazy about it is, in 2004, when I was graduating from Syracuse, NBC came to Syracuse and was looking for some students who were graduating from Newhouse, the broadcasting school at Syracuse. And they were going to pick 4 or so students to be runners, which is essentially like an intern at the 2004 Summer Olympics in Athens. I was like, yeah, I don't have anything to do this summer. Why don't I do this? I've always loved the Olympics. I love global competitions. I love the World Cup. I love all this stuff. And the pride, the patriotism, all that. The best of the best. And I got it and I was pumped. And then 3 days after graduating, I broke my ankle and I couldn't travel anymore. To think 20 years later, 2004, 2024, I've now been hired by the CBC to be a front-facing guy, not a producer, not a runner, not an intern, not a PA. They picked me. They reached out to me to represent them. And there's not going to be that many people from Canada there to be at the Village interviewing people, the best of the best. If Penny Oleksiak wins swimming gold in Paris, I get to interview her. That's mind-blowing. You know what I mean? So that's great. You know, the best broadcasters, you mentioned some of them, they were all at the Olympics, right? Kostas, he was Mr. Olympics when we were growing up. Jim McKay, Howard Cosell, Mike Tirico now, like the I think in order to be like considered the best of the best, you have to have some sort of presence at the Olympics. And so for me to like cross this and hopefully this becomes a thing, I would love it to be a gig every 2 years, right? Then I get to go to Milan in 26, and then I get to go to LA in 28 and all that stuff. That would be great. But I want to have, we got to do the show where I was interviewing people every week, and it was great. And I will pick that up. And I got so much joy and as I say, nachas from that, because I just love interviewing people that aren't in the sports world, that aren't in the combat world, aren't in the, in the world that we kind of the orbit that we live in. So I want to do that consistently. I've just sort of dipped my toe in the water. Like one thing that I always love, Howard Cosell, is the in-ring interviews. And I can never do that in MMA, because to do that, you have to work for the promotion. Joe Rogan, Daniel Cormier, Paul Felder, Mike Bisping, they're great. They work for the promotion. They work for the UFC. Same with the Bellator guys or the ONE Championship guys or the PFL guys. I don't want to work for a promotion. But in boxing, you don't work for the promoter. You work for the broadcaster. Like Mike Breen, who works for ESPN and calls NBA, or Joe Buck, who works for ESPN and calls NFL. And so when I'm interviewing, let's say, Jake Paul in the ring, I'm not getting paid by MVP. I'm getting paid by DAZN. That's huge. And I love that. God, I love that. Oh my God. Those 4 minutes in the ring interviewing the guys after this, like I've been in my room emulating those interviews as a kid, copying them, wondering, what do you say in that moment? How do you ask the question? Where do you go for X, Y, and Z? I want to do more of that. I really want to have more of a presence in the world of boxing. I adore boxing. It's not to say that I don't like MMA. It's not to say, but like, it's something different. It's fresh. So I have a lot of things. Maybe I'll be a heel manager in the world of pro wrestling as well. I got to cross that a little bit off the bucket list last year. So yes, there's a ton. I could go on and on. But if you want to boil it down to one singular thing, like I just love interviewing people. Love interviewing people. And so there's different permutations. I'm going to interview people in Paris. I get to interview people on my show. I get to interview people in the ring. When you boil it all down to something, like interviewer is probably the thing that I love doing the most.
Do you think there's a downside to having so many ambitions?
Hell no. Why would there be a downside? You only get to live once.
At any one time, it's like, oh God, I want to write this book. Oh gosh, I want to make this video. I want to write this thing. I want to do this podcast. And then, oh, by the way, there's all the things at the ringer that I want to do. In my experience, you can have so many ambitions at one time that you don't really end up accomplishing any of them, because you're splitting yourself so thin between all these things that you want to do, but you can't do all of them. So it's been stressful for me.
No, you have to be realistic. You don't have to do, God willing, we're here for a very long time. You don't have to do them within the year.
Yeah.
You can have long-term goals and short-term goals. This year, I want to do X, Y, and Z. In 10 years, I want to be the face of Olympic broadcast, I'm just making things up, right? But like, yeah. I'm realistic. It's not going to happen now. So you can say, I want to write 4 books. You don't have to write them this year. I think it's very important to have goals. I think if you don't have goals, like you stop living. I always talk about when I'm 85, I don't want to look back at my life and say, man, I blew it. Because I really do believe we only have one shot at this. So I don't want to live with regret. I have regret from when I was a kid about sweating the small stuff. I would sweat the small stuff. Like, why the hell did I get so nervous about that Hebrew test that meant nothing in the grand scheme of my life? Why the hell did I stay up all night, stomach in knots because of that math exam that means nothing? Now, of course, hindsight, it's hard to say that to a 16-year-old kid when you're living in the moment and you think these are the most important things in your life. But holy crap, I spent a lot of time worrying about things that most kids, I think, don't worry about. Like, I was a very nervous student, because I really, I don't know, thought that this would...
I can see that.
You know what I mean? I put a lot of pressure on myself. I don't want to have that kind of regret. And so, the pandemic taught us a lot. Go out there, do things, take chances, go on trips, accomplish things both personally and professionally. I'm a lot more... And a lot of this I actually learned speaking to a therapist. I remember... In the pandemic, I didn't really want to go anywhere. I just kind of wanted to stay local. Like, I'm very much a homebody. And this therapist, who was tremendous, told me, like, no, you go on this trip. Your wife wants to go to Boston. Go to Boston. Have a great time. And I was so apprehensive. I was so nervous. And then we went. And my kids still talk about that Boston trip. It was nothing special. But there was something about us finally going on a road trip and going in a hotel and being in an elevator. They hadn't been in an elevator in like a year and a half, which just stuck with them. And that... reminding me like, hey, you're also a dad and you're also helping to make memories for little kids who are hopefully going to have great long lives, and then they're going to be able to impart this. And so I want to take my boy. I have all these dreams and aspirations. I want to take my boys to, you know, I want to go on a Premier League tour of all these games in England and go watch all these things. And I want to go to a Bills game. And we went to one on my 40th birthday, and we went to a Blue Jays game. Like, I just want to do things when in the past I didn't really do those things. And so all to say, like, no, man, it's good to have things. It's good to have things to look forward to and to be excited about and to dream of. My dad always used to say, like, I remember one time my dad was talking to my girlfriend, now my wife, and he's like, this is before any of this started. And he's like, Ariel's a dreamer. He's too much of a dreamer. And now we joke about that because, like, I think that's my best quality. I always think, why can't it be me? Why can't I do this? It's good to dream. So I say, dream as many dreams as possible. Think about as many things as possible. Have as many things on your plate as possible, but just be realistic about it. They're not all going to get done by March, but, you know, hopefully we've got, you know, 40, 50 more years left and you can get them all done.
In a podcast that we did this summer with UFC ring girl, Luciana Andrade, you kind of said it in a throwaway comment, but it really stuck with me. You said that having kids not only changed your life, but saved your life. What exactly did you mean by that?
Saved my life, changed my life, because it gave me purpose. It gave me balance. It gave me a reason. It gave me distraction. I'm so intense and I'm so anxious as a person, and I'm so, you know, single-minded when it comes to work, and I just want to like obsess over things. I'm so obsessive that if I didn't have kids, if I didn't have a family, if I was just some single guy
like me,
yeah, I would, nothing wrong with that, but just, you know, our personalities are obviously different. I would be in my home or apartment just obsessing over work 24/7. I don't think I would have any balance in my life, and that would be incredibly unhealthy. The moment you have a family, first a wife, then a son, and then another son and a daughter in my particular case, you can't be like that. Now you take a backseat to a degree. Whether they're 2 months and need to have their diaper changed, or 12 years old and need to go to their soccer practice, it's not about me anymore. So, you know, would I like to sit at home sometimes and watch 7 straight hours of sports? Yeah, it'd be great. But my son has a soccer game, so I have to listen, you know, on an AirPod and have the thing on in my pocket, or, you know, make decisions about certain things. I got hit up in December by Logan Paul to be on his podcast, Impulsive, which is a pretty big podcast, as a guest. And I was like, wow, that's pretty damn cool, right? I mean, a lot of people watch that. Pretty amazing. My wife was working, and 2 of my kids had soccer games, so I had to turn it down. I just had to. That took precedent. So, you know, those things I think are incredibly, I'm blessed to have those conflicts, if you will. I'm blessed to have those distractions. I'm blessed to have all of that. And so I just felt like when I became a dad, it changed me for the better, because I was so intense about my job, about my career, about my goals, about my aspirations, which I still am, but I had nothing else. I had no other escape. I had nothing else that was taking my attention away from that. It's not healthy to be thinking about these things and worrying about these things 24/7. And so there's nothing better. I mean, it's just, I can't even tell you, there's no words to describe like the pride that I have in my kids and the joy that I have taking them to school, the joy that I have. I would choose going to a soccer game that one of my kids are playing in over any big fight in the world, no matter what. Are there moments where I'm like, oh, I have FOMO, this and that, when I choose, you know, family over this? Sure, that's natural, but I'll make that decision 10 out of 10 times. In fact, that's part of the reason why when my first child was born, I made a vow to do everything in my power to never miss a birthday. And I've had to turn down some pretty big things, including Ngannou Fury, because it was my daughter's birthday. Last year, Jake Paul was fighting Anderson Silva on my daughter's birthday, and Showtime was kind enough to fly my family just so that we can keep this streak going on. And I've not broken the streak yet. And so it's just amazing. And now that my kids are getting older, 11, 9, 7, to see their personalities, to see them develop into actual humans with own interests and traits and all that stuff, it's such a rewarding and beautiful thing. And now we're getting to the point where they're teaching me about things, you know, they're teaching me about music and sports and stuff like that, and like, what's better than that? So yeah, it's I'm scared to think of what kind of a human being I'd be if I didn't have any of this. I don't think I'd be a very fun person to be around, lovely person to be around, Ms. Bob. I would be a curmudgeon, and I don't know, I would not be very healthy.
I wrote in my book, which you so generously
yes.
Read and wrote a great blurb on the front cover. I wrote that the goal for young people as they think about their careers should be at the very beginning, which I think you'd agree with, to say yes to everything. Even yes. if you don't think it will lead you anywhere, even if you don't want to do it, just say yes to it. Get the experience. Maybe you meet someone. Maybe someone sees something that you do, and then it leads to something 5 years down the line. Say yes to everything. And then as you escalate in your career, hopefully, and enjoy some success, then you can begin to strategically say no to things. And I feel like that is something that you have experienced.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I remember, first of all, one of my favorite quotes comes from Woody Allen, who once said 85% of success or 80% of success is just showing up. Just showing up. So even if you're not at your best, it's way better to say yes and to show up than to just sit at home. And that helps someone, by the way, who has tremendous anxiety, because the best thing you could do when you have anxiety is to just say no and stay home. But if yeah. you just show up, who are you going to meet? What are you going to do? What's the experience? What's the conversation that's going to lead to the conversation, to the meeting, to the relationship, to the whatever? And so, yes, I remember one time in May of 2010, I was in Montreal and I was flying to St. Louis to go to a Strikeforce event. And I remember talking to a guy who was a friend/mentor named Dave Larzelier, brilliant guy in the TV business that I met. And he's like, why are you going to a Strikeforce event, man? Man, you've accomplished enough. You don't need to be going to all these events. Now, this is 2010. I was like, no, I need to go to every event. Every event that I could possibly go to, I need to go to. Over time, in large part because I became a parent I want to be home and I want to experience things and not miss out on things. And also because I tried to position myself as the guy who doesn't need to go to every event, right? Like I say sometimes, you know, Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, like they don't need to go to the red carpet. The red carpet stars come to them. You know what I mean? And I want that too. You know, I want Leon Edwards to come to me. Now, of course, as a broadcaster, as a journalist, like you need to be at the events from time to time. It's very important. But the point is, like, I tried to position it so that like people come to me as well, come to my house. So, it's definitely changed to where now I don't feel like I have to be everywhere within MMA. But then I want to be, you know, now like I've got this boxing dream, if you will, and I want to go to, like. I wanted to be at Haney Pro Gray. I really wanted to be there. I want to be at Taylor Cameron 3. I want to be at, if Ngannou fights Anthony Joshua, I want to be at these events because I think there's work to be done in those fields. I want to be at the Olympics, like I said, et cetera, et cetera. I want to go to WrestleMania if there's opportunities there. I think it's important to do some stuff, but I don't think it's important anymore for me to be somewhere every weekend. I was just talking to someone about April of 2010. There was one stretch in April of 2010 where I started the month in Toronto. Then I went to Abu Dhabi. Then I went to Nashville. And then I went to Sacramento, all between April like 3rd and 24th. That's absurd. Yeah. I can't do that now. And so, yes, I get to be a little bit more selective. And that's maybe a byproduct of my age and the time that I've put in, but there's still a lot more work to be done.
So you and I started working together, believe it or not, 5 years ago, which is crazy. What would you say is the biggest change in your career that you've had in terms of how you approach it in those 5 years?
Well, I would say, obviously we don't work at ESPN, but I know that you mean like more like how I tackle things.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, when I was at ESPN, I had aspirations. I did a little bit of NBA sideline stuff. I was on ESPN radio doing some stuff. But But I was still very, very focused on just being an MMA guy. And now I believe that I could be the MMA guy and I could be as good, if not better, of an MMA guy because I'm a lot more comfortable and confident giving opinion and whatnot. And also many other guys. The one thing that I would say like that I shed since those days, I really don't care about breaking news as much as I once did. I was once obsessed with that. And in particular, like 16, 17, 18, 19. And again, credit to our boss back in the day, Glenn Jacobs, who told me like, we don't care. We don't want that from you. That stuff is here today, gone in 5 minutes. Like it's the juice isn't worth the squeeze. And now a lot of people have made a ton of money off of that way of life, namely Woj and Schefter and Shams and Passan, and they're incredible at it. But I didn't, you know, obviously we deal in different sports and it's just a lot different when you're trying to break UFC news. And I did it, I accomplished it, and I'm not chasing it anymore. I much prefer to chase the big interview and have that relationship rather than this guy's fighting this guy and then that just kind of floats away and no one cares anymore. So that has changed tremendously. And just the way that I like view myself, I feel like I'm finally in a position where people are starting now to say like, oh, this guy is not just an MMA guy and he's not just a combat sports guy and he could do X, Y, and Z as well. And that's exciting because I'll be honest, like I've looked at other people getting attention, people getting love, people getting buzz, hoopla, spotlight on them, all that stuff. I'm like, man, I feel like I'm better than them. I feel like I'm better than them. I feel like I'm so much better than them. Why isn't anyone looking at me like this, talking about me like this? And I feel like that's finally starting. But again, like I said earlier, like there's so much, I feel like I said, finally starting. Like I need to do so much more in order to get to where I want to be.
So a big part of being a reporter and someone who books guests, you're essentially a professional networker. And I think networking is very important for people who want to ascend in their careers. I'm curious to know if there's any like little things that you do behind the scenes. Do you send birthday texts to fighters? Do you say like, hey, I saw that this thing happened, I'm thinking of you? Do you send mail, phone calls? Like, what are the things that you do to develop relationships with the fighters and the managers and the executives that go beyond just, hey, can you come on my show at 1 p.m.?
Yeah, that's a great question because I would actually say the irony is I'm a horrendous networker when it comes to just like day-to-day life. In fact, just like an hour ago, my wife was like, who can we invite for Friday night dinner? That's like a thing for Jews, Shabbat dinner. And I was like, can we invite no one? I'd rather not talk to anyone. I don't want to be on. I don't want to have to make conversation.
Wow. Don't you want you and Rick? Wow.
No, I want to invite. No, she's talking about like friends. I'm like, I don't want. And there was an article that was written about me in the Globe and Mail. New York Rick's invited anytime, by the way, to as are anyone else who's listening. But where the author noted something where, and it's true, where like my wife and I have kind of come to the realization that it's better that she just doesn't ask me. I don't know why she asked me this particular time, because usually it's like, oh, these people are coming over in 30 minutes. And that way I don't have to fixate and get nervous about it and all that stuff, because I do have some sort of form of social anxiety. But then when you come to my job, it's like, hey, you got to talk to people all the time and you have to, you know, stay in contact with them and have a good relationship with them. I think one thing that's very important that I say to other, you know, younger journalists, broadcasters is you can't just take all the time. You can't just reach out to people all the time when you need something. So yeah, there is it with everyone? No, but I do try to have great relationships with people where I'm not just asking. So I'm either checking in. Sometimes it's a birthday. I have it in my phone. I'll say happy birthday, or I see it on the internet. Sometimes it's a congrats. Sometimes it's a good luck. Sometimes it's a, you know, I hope this went well. Sometimes it's a, what's up with this? I'm not looking to report it, but you know, what's the status on this? How's this going? Sometimes people will call me and ask for my advice. And I would be lying if I didn't say that there's some people in the game who, you know, I've developed a friendship with. That's just human nature. You don't try. The first time I ever met Daniel Cormier, he asked me to go for lunch with him. It was in Chicago at a Strikeforce event. And I said to him, I don't go for lunch with fighters. And then he claims that he said to himself, like, oh, I'm going to make you my friend. And here we are pals. And I would definitely go for lunch with him. And this just happens. It's human nature, right? Like, I would go for lunch with Chael. There's this, like, Chris Weidman, like these people I like. And honestly, I end up talking to them more than I've talked to my high school friends now, especially because I don't live in the same city anymore. I always try to make it so that I'm not asking for things all the time. You comment on an Instagram story. You say, like, I love this video. This is great. And by the way, I'm not doing this because I'm hoping to cash in on this goodwill in the future. I just think that's like a mindset, right? An example. Yesterday, as we're speaking, Tom Aspinall went on a bit of a Twitter rant, if you will. But it was like the most like mild-mannered, polite way of saying, like, I want a title shot next. Tom Aspinall, the interim heavyweight champion of the UFC. I want an undisputed title shot next. And I thought his tweets were great. I thought they were clever. I thought they were fun. And I thought they were well put. And I just wrote to him, like, I love the tweets, man. Keep it up. I didn't say, like, love the tweets. Can you come on my show and talk about it? You know, like, I just was like, love the tweets. They're great. You nailed it. And then he asked me my opinion, and then we went back and forth, and that was it. You can't always just ask. And one thing that was very important for me when I started was being cognizant of people's time. So, like, I remember I always say, like, I'm not going to keep you more than 20 minutes. Because I, every time you book someone on the show, or you have someone on, you want them to walk away being like, that was fun, that was painless, it didn't take too much time, and now I'd be happy to do it again. But, you know, I've done shows where they've kept me on for like 2 hours. I'm like, yo, you know, last time I signed up for this, you know what I mean? So you just have to be cognizant of all these things. And I think it's very important to be professional, to be cordial, to not overstep boundaries, and also to be very grateful and appreciative and thankful. Like every single time someone is on my show, I send them a text afterwards. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Personal text. Like, I don't have a booker doing that. I don't have an assistant doing that. I think that stuff really goes a long way. And if someone got me that interview, if it was a manager, if it was a PR person, I text them too. I just think, like, it comes down to just being a good person, a good human being. And I've really tried to do that. And that's why it's funny when people say, like, oh, I have so many beefs and stuff like that. Like, think about how many fighters have been in the sport since 07 when I started 06. You could probably count the beefs on one hand, but they're so pronounced that it makes it seem like it's a thing. But in reality, it's been thousands upon thousands of interviews and fighters. And I'm very proud to say that I have a very good relationship with the vast majority of them. And I think it just comes down to just being a good person.
Yeah, I think it's one of my philosophies in life is just put good out into the world like you're doing with those things, and it will come back to you in some way. And people just love to latch onto the negative, as you know, and that kind of becomes the narrative. I want to steal a question from one of my favorite podcasts. It's called How I Built This with Guy Raz. He talks to a lot of entrepreneurs and CEOs and founders, and he ends every conversation with this question. How much of your success do you attribute to your own hard work, determination, perseverance? And how much do you attribute to luck, being in the right place at the right time? For you, I'm thinking you came up as social media was becoming a thing, as MMA was becoming mainstream.
Yeah, that's a great point, because 30 years ago, like, my path doesn't exist, right? There's, you know, a few networks on TV, a few networks on the radio, and then that's it. So I got very lucky. There wasn't even Twitter when I started. Facebook was meh. MySpace was the thing. And for whatever reason, I was able to recognize that and use that and use YouTube and all that stuff. So I would say I'm lucky that, yeah, I was born in this era. But I do think that a lot of it is more nurture than nature, if you get what I'm saying. And I feel like these traits are instilled in me, in large part because of my dad and mom. So I always say that I got my interviewing skills from my mom and my work ethic from my dad. Interviewing skills from my mom because, like, she's such a great person to speak to. She's attentive. She cares. You have to be very empathetic. empathetic when you speak to people. And she's the most empathetic person that I know. And she cares, she listens. And my mom is the kind of mom that, like, the friends would come over and just want to talk to her. Like one of my best friends, Mo, he lives in Montreal. Like he just stops by my parents' house just to speak to my parents. And that's incredible to me. And so I feel like that's where I learned a lot of these sort of traits. My dad, no one on this planet that I've ever met works harder than him. Like he was the kind of guy who like 7 a.m. he's out of the house. He comes home at 7 a.m. and then he continues to work at home till like 10 p.m., takes a shower, and then he starts over. And I witnessed working as the night shift guy who cleaned the factory in the middle of the night and then ended up buying the factory and expanding the business and took it over and became very successful. So I think that a lot of that is just instilled in me, and I witnessed it and I watched it. My family, you know, came from the Middle East, Lebanon and Egypt. They had nothing and they had to work their way up. You know, people talk about this immigrant mentality, and I do think it is a real thing compared to people that I know that are just sort of like third, fourth, fifth generation Canadian or American. And it's just like a different upbringing. I had to see not only my family scratch and claw, but I had to listen to the stories of what they had to overcome, you know, before I was born. And all that is instilled. And I do think that makes you into like a bit of a fighter and someone with a chip on your shoulder and someone who's not going to take no for an answer. And then there's a part of me that's like, I've had this moment many times throughout my life, like, how the fuck did I end up here? How did I end up here? Like, I remember sitting on the set of SportsCenter and being like, you know, Jewish kid from Montreal, you don't end up here. It just doesn't happen. How did I end up here? And then I start thinking, don't blow this. Don't wake up and screw this up. Keep this going. You're on the path. This is what you dreamed of. Now, like, the things are hooked in. Now keep it going, keep it going, keep it going. So now you have to keep going. And then it's the part of me that's like never being content. I've never left the show happy. In fact, the moment I say goodbye on my show, I'm like, fuck, how am I going to top that? How am I going to book this next show? Who am I going to get that's even a bigger name? Like my whole break that I was just on, I'm thinking about who am I going to book on the first show, then the second show, and then I have a list and I start to text people. It's like, it's just constant. And I think that's just ingrained in me, in my DNA. So, you know, luck, hard work. Ultimately, yes, I'm lucky that I am born in this era. But I would like to think if I was born in the 70s, I would be doing the exact same thing, but just using those mediums that were available back then and getting to where I want to be. No doubt about it. Certain things have to break your way. You have to have people looking out for you, rooting you on. And as you said, I really do believe in this as well. You put out good, hopefully it's like a boomerang in it, and it comes back your way. And if you put out evil and nastiness and toxicity, I think that comes back your way too. So I really just try to be a good person and you know, radiate that type of vibe, and hopefully it all comes back. And yeah, you know, I guess I just rambled there, but I do think a lot of it is just like what's ingrained and instilled in me. And that's because of my parents. And if I could also just add, the one thing about my parents, even though my dad always said I was a dreamer, they never said no to me in that when I told them I wanted to be Howard Cosell, they never said, that's ridiculous. When I told them I wanted to go to Syracuse, they never said, no one goes to Syracuse. No one goes to an American college in our community. It doesn't happen. You just stay in Montreal. They never said no. When I told them I wanted to move to New York to go work at HBO, they never said no. In fact, they always said, like, go for it. Why not? Yes. My mom listens to every single show. She like, it's the support that I got from them is immeasurable. And I think I don't get to where I am without that support. And so I feel very, very blessed and very lucky to be in those shoes.
Last question. And thank you for
that's
your
it.
Time.
That's all you got.
No. I've got one more. Okay. You know, listen, I could go 4 more hours. I want to prove. Yeah. But I want to be respectful of your time so that you come back. You asked this question to a lot of fighters who have been around for a while. When were you happiest in your career?
Yes. It is a good question. Would you believe me if I said now?
I would believe you.
Because when you're 1 to 10, you know, I have memories, but like you don't really remember your day-to-day life as much as, you know, you do these days. I'm sure those were great times, and I had a great childhood. When I was a teenager, like I said, I sweated the small stuff. In fact, there was one stretch in the 10th grade. I don't know if I've ever told you, like I started in one school and then I switched to another school and then I went back to the original school and then I switched. I switched four times in the span of a month. Have I ever told you that?
No.
Yeah. So like I was going through some stuff there. And then college, I was depressed, like I said. And then like post-college, you're like dealing with the trauma of those 3 years and you're trying to figure yourself out. And, you know, there's ups and downs, but I would say in 2000, okay. So it's a fascinating question because yes, now is great, but now there's other stresses, right? And you're getting older and your family's getting older and, you know, you have a house and a mortgage and stuff like that. But I'll tell you what, 2012, I get chills just thinking about this. May of 2012, I can almost like tell you the exact date. It was maybe like May 3rd or 4th, 2012. It's a Friday night. I'm living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in our apartment.
What?
Second floor. Beautiful Friday night in New York City. Friday night, my favorite time of the week. Love it. It's Shabbat, like I said, and it's just a great way to wind down the week. I'm folding laundry. I'm watching Bellator on, I think, I swear. I'm actually getting emotional just thinking about this. Watching Bellator on, I think, either MTV2 or, it was 2012, so they, maybe Spike, but I don't think the Spike deal started yet, so it was maybe MTV2.
This sounds depressing to me, not happy. I don't know where you're going with this.
I'm folding laundry. I'm watching Bellator. The window is open. Friday night, Williamsburg, I'm hearing people like going out to bars and clubs, whatever they're doing, or restaurants on a Friday night. It's maybe like 9 or 10. My firstborn son, Oliver, is at this point 6 days old, sleeping in a bassinet to my far left in front of me. And I swear, I remember this moment. It was like a moment of zen and bliss. I remember thinking, this is the dream. This is the dream right here. And so I would probably say the happiest I've ever been is in that precise moment. I remember like, I have a son, he's healthy. I have a wife who's healthy, who just gave birth, and that's a scary thing, right? I'm watching MMA, I'm folding laundry, like little like PJs. Awesome apartment, great city, New York City. I dreamed of living in New York. People are out. I'm not out, I don't wanna be out. The people are out, so there's activity, there's life. The weather is great. I love springtime in New York. I love summer in New York. And I just, I remember, I talk about it this way, I feel like it was like a lightning bolt of zen and happiness. For a kid who like always kind of was nervous and anxious and worrying about things, if you're asking me like, what was the apex, not like a period, just like the moment where I felt like the happiest, it might've been in that moment right there. I don't know. If a moment, like there's been great moments. I've been so happy to be in Dublin and Japan and Brazil and Australia and of course with family, but like that just felt like a moment where I took stock of my life. I was working for Fox. I was on TV. I had the MMA hour. People knew who I was. Like the career was rolling. I had good relationships with the UFC and Dana White, and there was no drama really in my life. You know, there was little things, but nothing like overarching. And I just remember feeling like, this is the dream and you did it. Well done.
That's such an awesome story because I think the best moments, if you're living life properly, the best moments are the ones, those small ones where there's nothing crazy happening. You're not in the ring at Mayweather McGregor. You're with your family, where you want to be, doing what you want to do, and just being really present. I think when you're present, those are truly the best moments. So that's a wonderful story. I've had a lot of moments because of you, a lot of like what you spoke of, how the heck did I get here moments. I don't belong here. I certainly didn't belong in MMA. I don't know how I ended up here, but I've gotten to live a pretty crazy life the past few years and do things I want to do because I fell into this somehow. And started working with you. Everything I have is due to working in this space and these shows with you. So Thank you for
I appreciate that. But the truth is, like, it's not really accurate, because if you weren't good at your job, if you weren't a good person to work with, trust me, I've worked with a lot of people. They're not around me now. I'm not calling them up to do the other jobs, the other things. I'm not recommending them for this and the other. So a lot of, like, you always need people to maybe open a door or give you a key, but then the rest is up to you. That person isn't holding your hand every step of the way. And so you have earned all those things because of your skills, your work ethic. The work ethic really is what I think sets you apart. Because there's a lot of people, like, you tell that story, it's almost unfair to yourself about the waking up on the Anthony Smith fight, because, like, you never say no. And we do shows, like, sometimes I think we do the post-fight show and I'm fucking tired as hell, PT is 6 a.m. and you then have to edit. And yeah. Like, I feel bad for you. You have to post it, edit, and then you send us the text like an hour and a half later or 2 hours later. And, you know, that's no fun. But you do it, and you do it with a smile, and you do it with passion. And I don't know if you'd be able to do it if you didn't love MMA, right? Like, you can't do this job if you don't love MMA. This isn't like one of those things where you're like a football producer and you're like, well, whatever, who cares about football? Because it really just sucks a lot out of you. One thing that I've always wondered, I don't know if I ever asked you this question, like, what was the, because I remember talking to you when I first met you, I don't even think you knew what MMA stood for, let alone the UFC or who Conor McGregor was or who Ronda Rousey was, et cetera, right? What was the conversation, the first conversation? Do you remember the conversation where someone's like, yeah, we want you to produce this podcast and it's about MMA? And were you like, ugh, MMA? Like, who delivered that news? Where were you? What happened? What was the reaction?
Yeah, so it was January 2019. At this moment at ESPN, I was still working at ESPN Radio, but I was trying to transition over into podcasting. And so to put me on like a sample thing, it was like the easiest thing that ESPN podcasting was doing was your show. Because from our side, on the recording side of things, just like, hey, just go sit in the studio and watch this show. It's essentially what it was. And keep track of all the times that Israel Adesanya and Colby Covington swear 60 times so that in the podcast, you have to like beep those out, which was really annoying. We eventually stopped doing that. But that was like, hey, Troy, go do this thing that no one else wants to do. We don't even really know what this show is. You go deal with it and figure it out. So I went into this cold studio, not in building 5 or whatever, which is an old abandoned building that no one was ever in. And I sat there and watched your show. The first time that I watched your show, I had heard of you. I knew, Ariel Helwani, that's that MMA guy. You came on a radio show in 2016, ESPN Albany, New York, that I was interning at. I may have screened your call. I screened a call for Ioana Jacek, having no idea who she was, and I was talking to her. And so I see you pop up on the screen, and you have this, like, MMA to me, bloodthirsty violence, gore. And here's you just sitting there in your studio with this smiley face with this like happy clown carnival music. And I'm like, what is going on here? What is this thing? And then, so I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And those first few weeks of watching those shows, I had zero idea what was going on. You're talking to these massive stars I've never heard of. I'm like, Colby Covington, George Masvidal, Leon Edwards, who are these people?
Do you remember the turning point?
The turning point. Okay, so I had to like listen to the show. Sure. I was consuming it. So just after a couple weeks, months of being force-fed this content, you listen and you start to get drawn to people. And Israel Adesanya was someone that I really like this guy. Now, this is before he's a champion. He's on the come up, but he's pretty much earmarked for this is the guy to watch out for. And I remember I was working at ESPN Radio on a Saturday night, and he just happened to be on. He was fighting Kelvin Gastelum. And I was like, wait, I know that guy. I've seen that guy before. I've listened to him. I actually know a little bit about him. I should watch this. And then that fight, as you remember, is one of the greatest fights of the last 5 years. And then I remember going to your show the next time Izzy was on. It was either the Monday after or the Monday after. That was the first time I listened, and it was like, I actually want to hear what he has to say about this. And he says, I was willing to die in there. And then that was the moment where I was like, whoa, these people are different. Yeah. I'm kind of fascinated by this.
I remember his face after that one in that interview, yeah. right? Like his face was all puffy, his lip was puffy and all that. Yeah, all it takes, because MMA is this sport where like the I always equate it to a treadmill that's on like level 13. And when you first see it, you're like, what the hell is going on here? Like, who are these people? What are their stories? Why do I care? And then if you can just like, you know, when the treadmill's still going and you could jump on the sides there.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment where you jump on it and then you start to gather your bearings. If you could just gather your bearings, it's a wild ride, right? Because it's just like so much drama, so much fun, so many storylines. There's nothing like the crescendo of like this guy versus that guy. And holy yep. crap, they're actually in the cage. They're actually, and I feel the same about all fight sports, but it's just different than anything else. Like Bills Dolphins is great, but it's not like music walking down and yep. lights and Saturday night. And you're like, ah, you're anxious. Like when Colby fought Leon, I felt anxiety. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's great. What's better than that? You don't get that anywhere else in my opinion. So it's great that you took to it. And most people that I work with who don't know anything about it, and then eventually, like our mutual friend, Connor, right? Like I know he knew a little bit about it, but like you see him now and he's like, you know, he's all in. And so most people, Mysterious Frank as well, knew nothing when I met him, and now he's all in. And there's a lot of other people, our other friend Jordan, and so many of the people that we met at ESPN, a lot of them didn't know much about this sport. And I feel like there's very few people that I meet after they work on it a little bit or like, nah, this isn't for me, right? Most are just like, oh, I love this guy or I love that guy or that was great. And then you start to see like, oh, wow, you're really into this. It's pretty amazing. No,
once you get exposed to it, it's hard to look away. It's just a lot of people are very hesitant to even expose themselves to it. I've been in situations, Connor as well, where we're in a room watching fights with a bunch of people who have no idea what this is, who've never seen it before. And even then, when we're forcing them to watch it, like they can't look away. There's just something about this sport that has you glued, even if you have no idea what's going on. It's really cool to watch other people watch it.
Yeah, no, it's riveting. And then you start to explain to them the stories and the backstory and what this guy has at stake and that guy. And it's like, you don't get this anywhere else. And that's why I'll never tire of it. But I'll tell you what, all the fights, you know, they kind of blend together. I can't tell you who headlined the UFC event a month ago. I could tell you who headlined UFC 101. Yeah. Forrest Griffin, Anderson Silva, BJ Penn, Kenny Florian. Because like there's just so much now as opposed to back in the day. But the characters, man. And to go back to what we were saying, like the interviews, the characters, there's no greater personalities out there than fighters. They're just different. You know, they expose their soul and they're willing to do it and they want to do it and they go out of their way to do it. And they're such amazing people to talk to. So that's why I don't think I'll ever get tired. All the BS, all the politics, all the drama, all this, all the fights, whatever. Why I love doing this job is because of the characters, the people, talking to them, learning about them. And then you get new characters and you get the Tom Aspinalls of the world and the Bo Nichols of the world. And there's this whole fresh new set of characters now to talk about. It never gets boring and they're so accessible to us. It's a privilege to cover them.
Okay. Real last question.
Okay.
That I wanted to ask.
I was starting to ask you questions. You see that?
Yeah, I know. You were going in interview mode. I had to take back control. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. This is, we do this thing on this show from time to time called Troy Stories.
Okay.
Play on words, Toy Story, Troy Story.
Oh.
Do you have any favorite Troy stories? This could be favorite memories, experiences, most quintessentially me moments, because I'm a unique character. I move about the world a different way. Any embarrassing stories, any times that we really butt heads that just, I made you really mad, just anything.
Well, I do remember our early conversations where you were like adamant for some reason on the length of the show. And I was like, first of all,
good time.
With all due respect, who the fuck are you? And why are you telling me this?
I feel like I still get that.
to a degree, but it's like, yeah, like what? You can't even tell me who Conor McGregor is. You're going to tell me how long this show is? And you know, I know you were just doing what you were told and all this stuff, but that's not necessarily what comes to mind. I would say what comes to mind is, so correct me if I'm wrong. You were at UFC 245, which was Colby versus Kamaru Usman.
Yeah.
I remember that vividly for a couple of reasons, but was that your first time ever in Vegas?
Yes.
Okay. And it was also your first ever UFC event.
No, I went to 44 the month prior.
New York. But this was like a road trip. It felt different. Yes. I remember a couple things. I remember your face in the arena. We were sitting up top, like way up top, because I was doing like the pre-show stuff and all that. And it was akin to a degree. Have you ever seen the movie Rudy?
No.
Oh, it's such a good movie. You got to see it. Anyway, the dad is like a lifelong Notre Dame fan. He walks into Notre Dame Stadium and he's like, this is the greatest thing my eyes have ever seen. Now, you didn't say that, but you had like this wide-eyed look on your face. You're like, holy shit, like this is the breeding ground. This is the spot. This is what I've been watching now for whatever it is. It's been a year, right? Because that was 245 was December of 2019.
Yeah.
So it had been almost like a full year of you working with me. And by now you have the bug. Like you like Colby Covington, you got your favorites, all that. And so I remember how like excited you were. This is why I love Connor so much, because Connor is me, you know, 20 years ago. Yeah. Everything is exciting for him. You know, he just became a fan a couple of years ago and he's so into, like Rick and I are kind of like at times a little cynical, curmudgeons, whatever. And he, I think, brings us back down into the fandom of when I'm doing the MMA hour. And so you had that in 2019 and it was beautiful to watch. And I also remember that we did a live show at Jimmy Kimmel's. Was it Jimmy Kimmel's?
Yeah.
On the Friday. And I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, these aren't necessarily quirky, but I'll get to a quirky one. I feel like you were incredibly proud of that. Because I remember we took a picture outside and like it made me proud because it was called Ariel Helwani's MMA show. But as you know, like with you, and this goes back to the quirk, like I wanted you to be on the podcast with your minimalist tip of the week because I thought it was fascinating that you were a minimalist, right? I've always, because I'm a student of Howard Stern, I like when there's other people on the show. I never want the show to just be me. I've never thought like, oh, producer, you stay in your lane. Dating back to the first ever MMA hour at AOL, there was a guy named Josh Audie. He was like the original producer. And I would have him on and he knew nothing about MMA. But I would just like talk to him. Dating back to 2001 when I started at Syracuse, my first show, the main event, when I told my parents, Howard Cosell, I created a fake producer, I don't know if I ever told you this, named Lester C. Dearson, named after former Prime Minister of Canada, Lester B. Pearson, and I would speak to Lester. I would say, Lester, did you see that? Lester did not exist. There was no Lester, but I just felt like there needed to be someone to play off of. And, you know, as you know, MMA are like, Mysterious Frank is the audio guy. I talked to him like within the first 2 minutes of the show. You know, and there's Connor and there's Rick and all that. Connor, like Rick was never supposed to be on air, but look at him now. So I remember you feeling a ton of pride and that made me feel good because like I always want everyone to feel like it's their show, not just my show. And that was a great feeling. And we also did the one in Chicago, which was great. But for some reason, like I specifically remember you feeling a lot of pride and that made me feel so good that you felt like this was our show and our moment, as opposed to just, you know, me and you're just kind of along for the ride. I also remember that you believed that all the water in the hotel room was free.
Oh boy.
And you drank a lot of water in the hotel room and you were charged for said water. True or false?
Yeah. I'm a slut for some Fiji water.
Yes.
And so the room in Vegas came with three big bottles of Fiji water. And so I drink so much water, the most hydrated man in podcasting. And so I drank those three bottles within 36 hours. The maid comes into the room the next day. Oh, you want more water? Yeah, I want more water. That was so good. That same thing happened about two more times. Checking out, Bill's on ESPN. Checking out, and they're like, yeah, you've got $296 worth of water. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I got them to cut it by 50%.
Oh,
but
nice.
I paid for that water.
Well done. Yeah. So that was like a welcome to the road, welcome to Vegas moment that I thought was hilarious. The minimalist stuff is still baffling to me. I do see some stuff behind there that feels not very minimalist, like if I'm being honest, but you're definitely
like
the
what?
First. I mean, what do you have? What is that? A Christmas tree right there?
Yeah, it's a Christmas tree.
That doesn't feel very minimalist.
I love, that's the one thing I collect is Christmas ornaments. I love Christmas ornaments.
All right.
Everything else though, I collect experiences.
But I'm not trying to put you down. I'm just saying, like, you know, I know you as the guy, like, I remember you being so proud of your little desk and your computer. And like, I got my Modelo when, you know, you took that picture. And I'm like, this is a weird way to live, but God bless. Or like, you have like three spoons in your house.
Still do. Bizarre. Only have three spoons.
By the way, talk about being antisocial. Like, what a unwelcoming sight for a guest. You have three spoons in your damn house? If I come over.
It's actually leads to more bonding. Because I say, hey, it's communal. Bring your own plate and spoon and we'll sit on the floor together.
Shoot me in that. I ain't coming over. What are you talking about? Bring your own plate? You want someone to bring your own cutlery?
If I had 10 spoons, you would never come over anyway. So
I would consider
it's a moot
point. Definitely
I don't
not
think
now.
You would.
So in any event, all those things come to mind. But as far as like podcast producing, things like that, you know, in my opinion, up until that point, up until meeting you, I'd never met anyone with your skills, you know, like Rick used to put together the podcast and he's incredible, but like, even he would tell you like, that's not his thing. You know, he didn't want to do that. It was just, there was no one else who was doing it. So it was great. It was a real pleasure. And I'm happy that here we are. What you said, 4 years ago, 5 years ago,
5 years. Yeah.
5 years.
Wild. Wild. I know.
Yeah, it is crazy. 5 years later, we haven't killed each other. I mean, we've only spent like, you know, maybe 10 days together in the same place. Maybe in those early days, a little bit more, but like post March 2020, how many times have we actually seen each other? You know,
maybe four.
Yeah. In person, that is.
Not via in person.
Zoom. But you've been a tremendous help in the new era with the Helwani show and all the other stuff that, you know, I've done and hope to do. Sure, you go on trips and, you know, you disappear into these weird places, but you still get it done. Like, we're doing interviews and you're in Hawaii at 5 a.m.
I know.
You know,
I can feel the judgment because I feel like you're always afraid. No. Is he in a place where he can get this done? But I always do.
Makes me nervous, but you're right.
I can tell.
You always get it done. So well done.
And that is the end of this here podcast. Wanted to go 4 more hours, but you're on a time budget this Friday.
Is this the longest one ever?
No, I think me and New York Rick went an hour 40.
Oh, all right.
Maybe one
Something
day.
Something to strive for.
Yeah.
You had him on twice before you asked me.
I've had him on three times.
Three times? Jeez.
Yeah.
All right.
Connor's been on three times too.
Really? Damn. Yeah.
How about that? No, Frank though. You beat Frank.
Yeah, well, I feel like there's a bit of a rivalry there. We don't have to get into it.
Yeah, we don't have to get into that. That's a podcast for today. Thank you.
PT Chuck, never.
In person only. They're on the in person only.
Wow.
Can't break the rules for them.
All right, fine.
Thank you for the show and for everything. That's all I can really say.
My pleasure.